Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking to guitarist, singer, and songwriter Nancy Wilson about her debut studio solo album and the story of her band, Heart. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll also review two new records, the latest from glam indie artist Art Deco and the return of the legendary English singer-songwriter Marianne Faithfull.
One more unfortunate, weary of breath, rashly importunate, gone to her death. Take her up tenderly, lift her with care, fashioned so slenderly, young and so fair.
Look at that is a little bit of a track called The Bridge of Sighs from the new Marianne Faithfull album, She Walks in Beauty. An odd collaboration, Greg, between Marianne Faithfull and Warren Ellis doing the instrumental music and Thomas Hood, the Romantic era Victorian poet. Who is Marianne Faithfull? She has been with us and been a treasure since 1964 when she had her first hit, As Tears Go By, written by her then boyfriend Mick Jagger, a year before the Stones recorded it. She fell apart for a bit after writing Sister Morphine with the Stones. She became addicted to heroin, but she came back in a big way in the new wave era with Broken English in 1979 and has been a vibrant performer, singer, songwriter ever since, collaborating with a new generation of musicians, Damon Albarn, John Bryan, Jarvis Cocker, doing some really interesting things. We nearly lost her last year. She had a serious bout with COVID, but she made it through the other side at age 74, giving us this new record. Let's play a track from it, and we'll talk more about it. This is the title track. The poem, of course, is by Lord Byron. She Walks in Beauty, by Marianne Faithfull.
She walks in beauty like the night, of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes, thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. One shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace which waves in every raven tress.
She Walks in Beauty from the new Marianne Faithfull Warren Ellis collaboration. That is the title track of this new album. You know, Marianne Faithfull has done just about everything except read romantic poetry over a backing track in her career. And now we have that moment. You know, she's talked about the idea of wanting to do this for quite a long time. And, you know, it happened to occur right around the time of the COVID outbreak. You know, she herself was a victim of that. You can hear the before and after tracks, the ones that she recorded before she got hit by COVID and then afterward.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of a fragile quality about this recording. The track, The Bridge of Sighs at the top that we played, That's a famous poem from 1844 by Thomas Hood about a young woman who commits suicide in London. She's living a life of, you know, despair and destitution, and death is almost a release for her. For these romantic poets, death and beauty are walking side by side through life.
Well, you know, the problem at the time was consumption. That was the plague of the era. Yes, they were fascinated with death and the beauty of death and the fragility of life, all those romantics. Fascinated with drugs, too, you know.
There was a lot going on there, and Marianne relates to a lot of it. You know, there is nothing precious about the way she reads these poems. I mean, it's like this is a voice of experience talking to you. Her elocution
is so perfect.
It's so, you know, there's a real depth there that you just don't get from just anybody. So the way she's pronouncing some of these words, like when she reads The Bridge of Sighs, that's my favorite moment on the record in a lot of ways. Anywhere, out of the world.
Swift to be hurled anywhere, out of the world.
You know, her escape, she's longing for that escape.
Yeah.
And then in Ozymandias, Shelley's poem, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. You know, the voice.
And despair.
The only thing, Jim, I'll say about this record, because I love Marianne and her voice, and the, you know, she's perfect for this readings. I find this very soothing in some ways, and
it's
also
beautiful.
Very, disturbing.
Yeah.
I wish Warren Ellis and her collaborators, who are clearly very smitten with her and are good choices.
Well, you say collaborators, plural.
Brian Eno. Brian Eno, yeah.
Two tracks of Brian Eno.
I wish there was a little bit more. It's sort of a backdrop, and they're trying to stay out of her way a little bit. I would have wanted them to push a little bit in terms of just what the arrangements could have been. I think there was a lot of potential there that was unrealized, but I still think this is a beautiful record.
Well, we also don't know how much the music was crafted in isolation, so that has put a damper on everything. But, you know, look, she's collaborated with some big ego stars, right? Billy Corgan was on that list, too. And many a fine young lad has been daunted by Marianne. You know, I think the only one who really kept pace was Damon Albarn and maybe Jarvis Cocker.
Right.
But it's beautiful. There's one misstep. There's a nearly 12-minute track that closes the album, Tennyson's The Lady of Shalott.
Yeah.
I guess Shalott lived down the block from
Shalott.
I don't know. I didn't get an A+ in romantic literature. You know, lived down the block from Camelot. But yeah, look, hey, every English teacher in the world who's trying to drive home the magic of the romantic poets, the pluses and the occasional minuses, hey, just make your students listen to this record.
Well, you know, that's a great
lifting.
That's a great point. It is like a concise introduction to these poems. One point I wanted to make, because I was thinking, like, what is the precedent for this kind of a record? I keep going back to Billie Holiday's Lady in Satin.
Mm.
You know, her penultimate record before she died. She died very young. Marianne Faithfull's outlasted her by 30-plus years.
Tragic heroine.
But, you know, the voice was kind of vulnerable at that point.
Yeah.
And there's a beauty in sort of that. You know, in Marianne's case, I wouldn't call it wreckage. In Billie Holiday's case, that voice was,
wreckage
there. But there is sort of a worldliness and a world weariness about those performances that really sticks with you once you hear it.
My mental state is all a jumble. I sit around and sadly mumble.
Other rock icons have attempted this spoken word thing, notably Lou Reed with reading the poems of Edgar Allan Poe. I don't think anybody could pull it off. You said before, ye mighty. You know, ain't no rock person's going to be able to say that with credibility, except, you know, romantic phrase after romantic phrase rolls off Marianne's tongue.
That is a track called Desires from the new Art Deco album In Standard Definition. Art Deco, we ought to clarify the spelling of Art Deco. It's a pun, obviously.
It's a pun, yeah.
Art as in the name Art, and Deco, D'ECCO. So apparently Art was a prodigy. You know, piano at 6, picked up instruments at 8, and his teacher was telling him he was, you know, way advanced for his age. Played in a bunch of Vancouver bands, a Canadian kid, and finally released a solo record in 2016. Dave Fevers, didn't do much, kind of reinvented himself immediately after. The story goes, and this is kind of a part of the lore.
Yeah.
You know, Robert Johnson had his crossroads, you know. Art Deco found a wig in a mall in
not
Canada.
Just any mall. A mall on Victoria Island, you know, off of Vancouver, which you have to understand is a little piece of 1850.
Right
off of Canada.
Right. So he basically sees this wig, buys it, and reinvents himself as this glam rock persona.
Yeah.
And that inspires the next record, Trespasser. Total transition into glam. And now we have a follow-up in Standard Definition that follows along the same path. This record is a step up in terms of production value. He's now working with Colin Stewart, who is the name guy in Vancouver for a lot of people. He's produced a ton of records, including by artists such as Black Mountain, Destroyer, Lady Hawk, etc. Now working with Art Deco on this record. We're going to review it in a second, but here's a track from it. It's called Head Rush from Art Deco on SoundCloud.
Is Head Rush, and indeed it is Mr. Cott, Art Deco. Man, I love that track. I love this album. I love the whole persona, the gender bending, and the glam rock encyclopedic history. You know, we have T-Rex, and we have Bowie, and we have Mott the Hoople, but, you know, he follows the logical progression through the new romantics. In many ways, those 80s synth bands from the UK, you know, we have a lot of Cure in here, and we have Gary Numan. You know, he's kind of taking this whole thing and mashing it together, but he's a very talented keyboardist, and so we also have these two instrumental interludes which hint at a fascination with Tangerine Dream and its great soundtrack music. So the synth sounds throughout are incredible. The dance floor feel of a song like Head Rush and I Am the Dance Floor. Mm-hmm. Indeed he is on that song. That is his preferred pronoun, although in the glam tradition, you know, there's an androgyny, there's an experimental kind of phase. This is Aladdin Sane, but, you know, for 2024. I love this record, and it's a fun listen from beginning to end. And it's also a smart commentary on the obsession with fame. You know, and so there's a lot of commentary about what media and television and celebrity worship does in a kind of low-key way. It's not heavy-handed ever. Mainly, this is just bubblegum dance music.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think the subject is rather played out. It's not like we haven't heard this before, times, right?
But the whole notion of
glam rock,
not
too.
With so many hooks.
We've heard it. Exactly. I mean, that's where I come down on this record, is that despite the subject matter perhaps being overplayed, the songs are really good. And the variety of the songs, the one track that sort of got me, the Desires track that we played, I thought this was a really cool reference about feeling played out. He's in his 30s, and he's kind of referencing this whole idea, like, when do you call it quits?
Mm-hmm.
It may be over for me, too. You know, he's not just pointing fingers at the old guy down the street, like, get out of the way, here come the kids. I'm going to be one of those people, too.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, to my mind, he was referencing a little bit of Scary Monsters era Bowie here, where Bowie's kind of looking back at his career and going back to that guy he was when he was just a kid. You know, you're kind of full circle. Nobody knows you, then a lot of people know you, and then you're back to nobody cares. And nobody knows you again. So he's kind of playing that cycle through, and I thought, cool idea, I like it. That track I remember, wow. I mean, the arrangement on that, that's where he ends the record with the acoustic guitars and the strings. He's got some real strings on here, some real players.
There are some neat string sounds. Apparently it's the Victoria Orchestra.
There is a part in that song where those vocals go, you know, there's this beautiful shift into falsetto on the vocals and this euphoric counter melody on those synths. He's playing these vintage synthesizers. Wow, what a cool moment on the record. Just kind of gives you a little chills, you know? And I have to say, that track you said, you talked about, I Am the Dance Floor,
mm-hmm.
I turned my kitchen into, I was playing Art Deco the other night, and Art Deco. I was on the dance floor.
Confirmation of that.
Listening
from,
to that track
Mrs.
on the kitchen.
Scott.
Well, the kids were shocked. They were all over, and it's like, Dad's dancing again by himself
while he's washing
dishes, you know?
But I tell you, COVID locked up too long.
Exactly. So thank you, Art Deco, for helping me pass the time in a more constructive way. You know, at least I'm dancing.
That is what we think of the new albums from Marianne Faithfull and Art Deco. And now we want to hear from you. Let us know your opinions in our Facebook discussion group, on Twitter, on Patreon, or leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up, we'll talk with guitarist and singer Nancy Wilson about how she got into music, touring the world with Heart, and her first solo album on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
All good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
No reason to hurry. No reason to worry. 'Cause you always show.
And we're back! And that is a little bit of the song You and Me by our guest this week, guitarist, singer, and songwriter Nancy Wilson. It is from her debut studio solo album of the same name.
Nancy's probably best known for her work in the band Heart. Since 1975, she's been captivating audiences with her masterful guitar work and beautiful vocals alongside her sister Anne. In addition to her stellar work in Heart, Nancy's also written scores and curated music for films like Almost Famous, Jerry Maguire, and Vanilla Sky. She's also co-written a book with Anne and journalist Charles R. Cross on the story of Heart, Kicking and Dreaming, in 2012.
We are thrilled, absolutely thrilled, Mr. Cott, to welcome Nancy Wilson
yes, indeed.
To Sound Opinions. Nancy, thanks for doing this.
I'm happy to be here.
The first solo album... In all of these years of music making, you started when you were 20. Why You and Me? Why now?
Well, something I wanted to always do for quite a long time. Girls and boys have asked me, when are you going to do a proper studio solo album? And I was like, well, as soon as, as soon as there's a pandemic and I get shut all over here.
When hell freezes over or a pandemic hits.
When the worst crisis in a century hits us.
Yeah. Right. When the world stood still. It's definitely a blessing, even though the larger situation here has been really the worst, curse we could ever have lived through. The whole attention span has shifted as well. Before we were shut down, people were kind of like, okay, you know, listen to the first 5 seconds of a song and then on to the next, you know, check it out. I like it. I don't like it. Next, you know.
Yeah.
Now, like when I released my first single, The Rising, the Bruce Springsteen song. Come on up for the rising. Come on up, lay your hands in mine. Come on up for the rising. Come on up for the rising tonight. La, 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 la. Which is about 5 minutes long. And people were like, oh, I love it, I love it, I love it. It's an immersion into a world where you can escape from reality and go into a journey through song and not be bored immediately. So it's really an interesting observation for our times right now.
Well, and what you did with that song, taking it in a folk direction, I saw a great quote that you'd given that part of the inspiration for making this record, you were surrounded by all your guitars at home, all your amps, and you were connecting with your pre-heart self when you were in college, creating, quote, poetic, intimate, romantic songs. Why don't you take us back there, Nancy? You know, because I think people know the Love Mongers, you and Anne, your sister, doing, you know, semi-acoustic. But, you know, the idea of you 18, 19, 20 playing in college folk songs.
I was a brave soul that it would you go out and do solo acoustic, you know, coffee shops and little taverns, little bars and stuff, because I was trying to earn money to buy a better guitar and record.
Yeah.
So I had an early experience, more intimate experience. I mean, I would play stuff like Stairway to Heaven by myself. I would play Jethro Tull. I would play rock songs and Beatles songs and Joni Mitchell songs and Neil Young songs. And, you know, so I had like a gamut of a variety of the types of songs I could do. Even Misty. I even learned Misty. So somebody always has to request that if they had a drink or two, right? So play a Misty for me.
You're right.
So, yeah, so I kind of became adept at, you know, accompanying myself and learning how to play guitar more like a one-girl band, you know, sort of. I learned how to rock it, how to put bass lines in, how to be a rhythm player, kind of a semi sort of lead player inside of rhythm parts. And so that experience in college being a solo artist was really a great, you know, learning curve for me to know how to kind of be writing stuff on my own. And then knowing that I was going to eventually joined the band because Anne had an open invitation sitting there for me. But at first I had to kind of go find my own, you know, declaration of independence outside of Anne because I was always the shadow, the little sister, the shadow. So I think I really gained a lot of footing there and I was able to kind of bring those tools into the band when I finally joined the band. And I kind of brought the acoustic sensibility to that band and a lot of more harmony singing as well.
Yeah. Guitar playing, it sounded like you were doing a lot of trial by fire, like in performing in front of people. But did you have a teacher, or were you completely self-taught? How did that work early on?
Well, early on, I was just, you know, learning by ear. I mean, I'd had a lot of music all around me with our family, you know, aunts and uncles and granddad and grandma and cousins, and we'd all get together and we'd all sing harmonies and play ukuleles, and there's piano around all the time. And yeah, I come by it honestly, and I Never really, except for a couple of piano lessons that didn't go well. My teacher had a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
It wasn't my fault, but still, she was on a different path. But anyway, So I just brought all my natural ability to the guitar, learned the chords from the Mel Bay chord music book, you know, that you got at the music store back in the music Ma and Pa music store days. And I learned how to play the G and the C and the D and the couple of suspended and diminished type chords. But I already had theory, because when you sing harmony with your family and the intervals in harmony singing, you know, you already have the structure and the blueprint for music theory. And I took music theory when I was at university too. And boy, I narrowly escaped that class.
Knowing too much can ruin you, right?
It's really so mathematical. I was like,
yeah.
This is deep water for me, but I still passed, and it was really, you know, a good education. I learned a lot too. Yeah. So I learned a lot to bring back to the band once I finally joined.
What I'm curious about, and you said you joined the band and it was like a fait accompli, but the story that I keep hearing over and over again is that you had to audition for the band. Was that true for your sister's band?
Well, she was the front person, and she had already warned them that I was going to come into the band, but they were not so happy about it. I mean, you know, it was the group of guys that kind of weren't so sure that bringing another girl into the band wasn't going to wimp out the band. Like, oh, now we're going to have to, you know, do flowery ballad. More than one girl, look out. But also when we had the album started, because when I first walked into it, they'd already been turned down by every major label a couple of times. And then the local indie label called Mushroom Records was interested, because they'd seen Anne sing in a club, in a cabaret in Vancouver, and I was like a newcomer in the band, so we were all already writing. There was a producer who came, Mike Flicker, Sauce. It was word of mouth that there's this amazing singer down at the cabaret, and I was just new into the band, so he said, I want to make a record with you guys. And so I was like, oh, cool. This is just my luck. I get to join a band that's immediately going to make a record, which was a dream. And so when the record company guy came and the producer guy came to our house, the band house, we all lived together. You know, it was sort of like, okay, we know what Anne can do, but what can her little sister do? So why don't you audition here and play and sing something for me now? So it was really nerve-wracking, because was me in a living room with the band and a couple of, you know, business guys. They were kind of like, okay, thanks a lot. We're gonna go talk in the next room. And what they did was they said to Anne, they said, you know, she's not as special as you are. Okay, so really what we want is you. We want you, and we want to put you up front and probably hire a few new musicians as well. And she was like, I don't go anywhere without my sister. So she said no. And she turned down a golden opportunity to be, you know, an ornamental front girl in order to stick to our plan, which was to join forces and be songwriters and be in this band together. So, yeah, it hurt my feelings. Like, it really hurt my feelings. But then when she stuck up for me and said, no, we're doing this together. And I think we did okay.
Well, those first albums, Give Us Magic Man and Barracuda, you know, that's you know, those are a heck of a salvo coming out of the gate.
Yeah, yeah, we came to play.
This year alone, you know, one of the guitar manufacturers put you on a list of the best female guitarists ever, and you got this She Rocks Legend Award, all right? You know, and I'm thinking, you know, the album ends, the new album, You and Me, with a track called For Edward, which is a beautiful tribute to Eddie Van Halen that starts with a kind of classical mode and then shifts into Eddie Explosion. No one ever called Eddie Van Halen one of the best male rock guitarists. And here you are, after all these decades, we still have to qualify. Not Greg and I. I wonder if that pisses you off. You know, Anne is always, I've interviewed Anne more often than I've gotten to interview you. Anne gets mad, and I love that, right? But you just generally seem to, like, shrug off that kind of stuff.
Oh, you know, when I was just starting out as a player, like about 9 years old, I really took to it. Like, I was obsessed with playing guitar, and I got really proficient really early as a kid. By the time I was 12, you know, I was doing, like, able to play stuff like Angie, you know, the Simon Garfunkel instrumental song. I had finger style going, I had rhythm style going, I had probably better than I am today style, but because when you're just consumed with learning and the love of learning an instrument like that, it gives back, and it's your best friend, and you know you want to just sleep with it in your bed, you know. It's like not very comfortable, I gotta say, but
not as bad as a drum set though.
Yeah, drum set.
I don't need any room in the bed.
Excuse me, Mr. Cymbal, I gotta move over this way. Yeah, so I go down to the little music store, Bandstand East in Bellevue, and I'd go, you know, play guitars there that were better than the one I had at home, and I'd sit in the music store and I'd just, like, show off, you know. I'd just, like, show off, and people would come around and go, whoa, their jaws would kind of hit the ground, and they'd be like, how old are you? You know, like, little girl? And I was just like, yeah, I'm 12. Yeah, I'm good. Okay. I was just a show off. And I think that before, as at that age too, before I had any kind of gender specific, you know, awareness of my sexuality, I was just a kid who was kind of sort of novice, you know. And so when people kind of ever put me down or never included me in their lists or whatever, which never really happened until recently, I just don't, why should I care? You know, I feel like what I've earned as a player is the magic that happens on live stages and how people, how you see how that absorbs into their lives and what it means in their lives. And, you know, we do these meet and greets before shows often, most of the time, and that people are like, oh, you and your guitar playing, nobody ever, you're the most underrated, you know, guitar player. And it's like, yeah, but you're here gushing at me, so that's all that matters to me.
Yeah, that connection. Yeah. Sweet, roll over, roll over, roll over.
pioneering guitar player, you know, I think also the fact that you mentioned the harmony vocals, which were so critical. Did you and your sister used to sing together when you were growing up? I imagine you had to, right, to have that sort of natural chemistry.
God. The whole family were singers together. I mean, Anne had a thing. She had this knack to imitate other singers. And her best one at any party, like the family would go, my mom and dad would go, Anne, girls, come downstairs. Do your Ethel Merman imitation. So Anne would do it. You know, it's just a little kid going, this is a moment.
Yeah.
And she's big. You know, she just had this big gift, big delivery system of a voice with, you know, all kinds of presence and all kinds of, it would, you know, she'd fill a room with her voice, with or without a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd make little bands with girls in our school. We'd enlist them to come be harmony singers with our two, me and Anne would play guitars and we'd do, you know, popular music. And we'd go play places like gymnasiums and schools. And we actually played at a drive-in theater one time.
Before the movie or in between?
It was before the movie. As the sun begins to set, you know, there would usually be somebody that would go, all right, folks, you know, the movie is going to start in another 20 minutes. And, you know, go get your concessions now at the concession cafe or whatever. And so somehow somebody knew someone that said, hey, these girls can sing. Maybe put those girls on for 20 minutes before the movie. So it was like there's this one, you know, wooden podium and one microphone sticking out of it that we were all, you know, huddled around this one microphone.
Yeah.
Doing stuff like Peter, Paul, and Mary, you know, If I Had My Way, and, you know, like rousing folk music stuff. So we had a lot of genres we could cover. And, I mean, Heart Still has always been a pretty versatile, you know, in our songs, too. It's a big spectrum of stuff we can pull off.
Coming up, we talk with Nancy about how a low point for Heart in the early 80s led to a massive commercial comeback, and her feelings on the band's hair metal era today. Plus, touring with Queen and how Heart became mentors to burgeoning Seattle bands, including Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, and Nirvana. That's up next on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
There I was with the old man, stranded again, so off I'd ran. A young world crashing around me, no possibilities of getting what I need. He looked at me and smiled, said, "No, no, 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 child. See the dog and butterfly."
We're back. This week we're talking with guitarist, singer, and songwriter Nancy Wilson of Heart. Let's get back to the conversation.
I'm fascinated by Heart's arc. You know, you started out with those first couple albums, which were just huge and had a bunch of hits right out of the gate. And then, you know, Nancy, what I'm thinking is, like, you hit that trough in the early 80s where things sort of bottomed out a little bit. You know, I know that some of the band members were having some substance abuse issues. Yeah. And a lot of bands would have probably called it a night, you know, at that point. And yet Heart persevered and then had another string of hits in the mid to late 80s, into the 90s. Now you've had hits in four decades. How did you sustain that in that period of crisis, keep going, and then come back in many ways stronger than ever, having more hits?
I think, you know, dogged determination is one part of it. Being from a military family and all that, you know, we knew already about the average lifespan of most rock bands. You know, you're very cool for about 5 years, if you're lucky, and then you're not cool. And so you have to reinvent, you know, and, you know, renew your vows.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, reinvent your fashion statement, reinvent what's happening in the culture, because that keeps reinventing itself. And it's easy to become passé when that happens, too. So, mm-hmm. And we got a little too full of ourselves, I think, at the beginning of the 80s there, too. We were like, oh, yeah, we can do no wrong, and, you know, we're cool no matter what. And that's when we had our worst flop, you know, of a private audition was mm-hmm. the album, because we just got so full of ourselves, we thought, oh, you know, we could do, like, slapstick songs. We could do, you know, the Beatles did stuff like that on the White Album. We are the Beatles, aren't we? So we got lazy, and, you know, we got spoiled, and we kind of got dropped almost. And so in order to, you know, to survive, we kind of saw the 80s coming in with MTV, with all of the bombastic and big hair and the costumery of it all. And we kind of said, okay, whatever it takes, we're going to do it so that we don't get, you know, left behind. And so that was a, as we say, a far out learning experience, mm-hmm. going through the 80s, the mid 80s into the late 80s, because, you know, there were songs by other people that they really wanted us to do, and we still had our own songs on our albums, but there was a real pressure to do these LA stable songwriter songs, like Aerosmith. All the bands were being yeah. pressured to do the same things. And yeah. so we kind of put on the costumes, and we did the videos, and, you know, my feet still hurt from the stilettos and.
Well, and, you know, I did a piece on with Anne at that point about the sexism of Anne, you know, was not perfectly curvy like Playboy model. She was curvier. And, you know, and so therefore she shrouded in veils. And it was a great interview, and her frankness and honesty, you know, and having had that kind of industry manipulation foisted upon you, it then felt like such a victory when your fellow Washington State musicians of the early alternative era were claiming, you know, you and your sister, not as great female inspirations, as great rock inspirations, period.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it was really an amazing moment. You know, I always say that at the end of the 80s, the moment Smells Like Teen Spirit arrived in the culture, there were all these bands that had record deals, you know, with big hair bands that had record deals that were instantaneously just dropped.
Yeah.
Because the entire culture shifted like a flash mob right then at that moment. And we were like, we were that band, you know, we were shallow, and now we're dinosaurs. And why did we allow ourselves to be, you know, kind of forced into those outfits and stuff like that, and be simpering and pouting and pinning the lens and all that stuff? So we went back to Seattle with our tail between our legs, basically. And that's around the time my best, oldest, dearest friend, Kelly Curtis, who then was managing Mother Love Bone before it became Pearl Jam, was sad to tell us that Mother Love Bone's singer, Andrew Wood, had had OD'd and was no longer. So they had come to us, to me and Anne, and said, can you, we had a record deal, of course, that just fell through because there's no singer. Mm. And we're looking for a singer. And is it possible you could loan us a few months of money to live on until we can find our new singer and get another record deal? Mm. So we said, yeah, we're going to loan you a few grand here and just write a little IOU out. I'll put it in my back pocket.
Wow, that's cool.
We lent those guys money, and then they found Eddie Vedder, and they paid us back.
That worked.
I'll bet. Yeah, they owe you. They should pay you times 10 for that deal.
Yeah.
It worked out pretty well for them. Sad for Andrew, though, obviously. Yeah, what a crisis.
And we went to Andrew Wood's kind of wake in Seattle, and that's where we met all the Soundgarden and, you know, Screaming Trees and Alice in Chains and all those bands and all those cool guys who were so sweet to us and received us with open arms and respect and admiration. It's like, you know, me and Jerry Cantrell, first time we jammed was like, how do you play the beginning of Mistral Wind? You know, because it's that great dissonance that, you know, the beautiful kind of dissonance thing that Alice in Chains is so well known for. So we got our brotherhood there now, and we still do. Everybody still supports each other in that community. It's so different from the LA community, where it's an industry town. Seattle is a community, music community town.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also have read that there is perhaps a Heart biopic in the works, kind of modeled on that Queen movie that was surprisingly very good.
That was amazing. I loved Bohemian Rhapsody.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it didn't seem like it would work, but it did.
Mm-hmm.
Did Hart ever play with Queen in the day?
Oh, God, yeah. We toured Europe with Queen and Nazareth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were just newbies at the time. We were really, we were just getting started. Our album was, you know, new. It was a new album.
Yeah.
We toured with Queen, I think probably because of Freddie Mercury picked us, because, you know, it takes a diva to want to work with another
diva. It takes a diva to know a diva.
Yeah.
Know a diva.
That's right.
You know, a very talented diva to know.
Yeah.
So it was fun because Brian May couldn't be a sweeter person on the planet. And they were all really great. They were all really supportive. And we got to, you know, we got to crouch behind the PA column and watch their show every night after we'd played. And backstage, Freddie was so, you know, enamored with Anne, the divas that they are. He'd be like, "Oh, Anne, oh, Anne," you know. You have a spare black eyeliner, you know.
Swapping makeup tips.
Oh, God.
Yeah, right? You always had an extra one just in case.
But will there be a biopic? I mean, you start your film career as girl in car. In Fast, a pretty girl in car, I'm sorry, in Fast Times in Ridgemont High. Mm-hmm. Are you now going to be immortalized on screen, possibly by some young, talented musician actress?
Well, yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, we had meetings with Carrie Brownstein, who did Portlandia.
She's brilliant.
She's a great writer. She's funny. Not sure, you know, what Amazon is going to do about her directing or not directing. We don't know, but that would be cool, too.
That would be all right.
The script, you know, the last version of the script that I read was really cool. There's always going to be a few notes, you know, still to do to incorporate. And it's based on what the book, Kicking and Dreaming, it's that timeline. It's more right. about, you know, young girls getting their start and mm-hmm. finding that their sisterhood is their survival mechanism through which to endure the lifestyle.
And you and Anne wrote that together, right?
The book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with Charles Cross from Seattle,
right.
who wrote a whole bunch of amazing rock books. But we worked with him for a few years, actually. He came out on the road, and we interviewed, and he recorded. And most of it's in our own words. But so that's kind of where the script goes from there to there. It doesn't go past. It's not about husbands, you know, or anything. It's kind of about that exact era.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. It has been an honor and a privilege talking to Nancy Wilson of Hart with a fantastic new solo album. Thanks, Nancy, for being on Sound Opinions.
Thanks, you guys. Happy to do it. I love talking about music. I could do it all day.
All right.
That wraps up our conversation with Nancy Wilson. And as always, we want to hear from you. Share your opinions with us at our Facebook discussion group, Patreon, Twitter, or leave us a voice message at our website, soundopinions.org. Also, look out for our bonus podcast episode where we talk more with Nancy about the future of Hart, her film score work, and Jim and Nancy's meeting on the set of Almost Famous.
Good stuff, Greg. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to take a deep dive into the history of Malico Records, a really important label in the world of gospel and soul music.
Fascinating story, too. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our intern, Sol Delgadillo.
Just the mention of your name turns the